Are you listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other platform where you can leave a rate or review? Do you like what we're doing? If the answer to all of that is yes, please consider quickly giving us a 5-star rate. And if you wouldn't mind leaving us a nice review, we greatly appreciate that as well. Okay, let's do this.
Hello, welcome to the Ghost of Harrenhal. My name's Simon.
And I'm McKelly.
Thank you for joining us for episode 234 of our chapter-by-chapter book review of A Song of Ice and Fire by George Martin. Today, we'll be discussing chapter 8 of A Feast for Crows. That's Jamie 1.
Yes, it is. It is not Cersei 1.
This is not the only time in today the notes are going to trip us up, because there's one that you wrote earlier where you put a really good typo, and I was so puzzled by it. I sat looking at it for like 10 minutes, like, what the heck is he talking about? I'll reference it when we get there.
All right. Well, as always, we're going to chat about the chapter and try not to spoil any future plot points for you. Hopefully, we're going to provide you some entertainment along the way.
We will summarize what happened, discuss our thoughts on it, provide some useful background, compare it to the television show, indulge in a little pedantry, and cover some relevant news and listener correspondence. Be sure to check out the show notes to provide some additional information about the characters and geography of this chapter. How are you, McKelly?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for delaying a little bit to get started. We had a little bit of family drama that needed to be worked out. So everything is on the up and up now. So
broken hearts in the Ray household.
Yes, yes. And, you know,
I'm sorry,
requires conversations and such. But poorly timed conversations at that. But, you know.
Well, we are recording in the week of the great eclipse of 2024.
Yes.
Which was absolutely breathtaking. I went to the city of Dublin, Ohio, which Carson chose because Carson does her homework, but it's roughly where I chose because it is just about the closest point on the totality line to where we live, which
Wow.
was 8 hours drive still.
Ah, yes. 8 hours drive for 6 minutes of magic.
Not even that. Right. We didn't go all the way to the center of the totality line, so we only had 90 seconds, in fact.
Oh, wow. So, okay. So a few years ago, 2017, we had one much closer to us, about a 2-hour drive. And a mutual friend of ours, Mark, he and his family drove down there. And Mark said it was one of the most memorable and amazing moments of his life. And now Mark did not make the drive this time, which I checked with him. 2 days ago. Anyway, he did not make the drive. So you made a longer drive. What's your takeaway?
Because he was right the first time and he was wrong this time. It's absolutely worth it. If you can go and see a total eclipse, it's absolutely worth it. It's an absolutely amazing experience. I don't have any photos because I simply put my phone down during it. I was just like, I'm just going to bathe in this amazingness. Now, I have my 8-inch telescope, which helps. Because, so at totality, the sun disappears and you can see the corona of the sun around it. So you've got this glow around the sort of black circle of the moon. But around the edge of the circle, you can see red dots.
Oh.
Through the telescope, you can see that those are solar flares coming off the sun. And they're incredible to look at.
Use the telescope to see the eclipse.
Exactly.
Wow, that is pretty neat. The whole time, or did you?
Oh yeah, I have a solar filter. So until totality, the solar filter was on there, so we could watch the whole experience. And then at totality, whip off the solar filter and see the
very cool.
It was truly amazing. I think I've told you before. I probably said it on the podcast before. We went to the 2017 one as well, and I'm the astronomy buff. Of the family. But on the drive home, which was hours and hours of gridlock traffic, I thought Carson was going to murder me because I exposed her to this. But instead, as we got home 4 hours later than I anticipated, she said, I'll go anywhere on Earth to see that again.
Wow.
Including Dublin, Ohio.
A convert.
Mm-hmm.
You created the convert. Now, you said you didn't get a picture. And I would just say, if you're looking for a great picture, Jenny posted one that she took. She was also in totality. It's
fantastic. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It was really cool. We were only about, I think, 82% here locally. And I was trying to use to hold my glasses up to the lens of my camera and take a picture, but I just could not get it to work out. So
I have a bunch of photos of the build-up and the wind down, which I'll happily post to the Discord server, or at least one or two of them. I'll be selective. Taken with my cell phone through the lens of the telescope. So they're pretty cool, but they aren't totality. And I mean, 82% sounds good, but really when you're talking about eclipses, the difference between 99 and 100 is pretty big.
Oh, yes, yes. Here, it got a little dusky.
Yeah.
For about 20 minutes.
And did you go out and see the light through the trees?
Yes.
Yes, that's a pretty thing to do, yeah.
Yeah, it was neat, but it was a little, you know, it was nothing compared to what you all saw,
well,
I'm sure.
Well, I mean, for 95% of the time I was looking at the solar eclipse, it was very similar to what you saw. It was just that little middle bit was super special where I was.
Yes.
And again, Dublin, Ohio, which is basically practically a suburb of Columbus, Ohio. I'd never heard of this place. I had no... It was absolutely beautiful. Have you heard of Dublin, Ohio?
Well, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, so, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with Ohio cities.
You think these two things are connected. Good. I understand that.
So they're neighboring states.
It has a river running through it, which is for me, as an English person, it's a vast river. It's called what's the river that runs through Dublin, Ohio?
The Ohio River?
No, although I did cross the Ohio River, and that really is an enormous river. That is huge. And not only is it huge, but it's huge a bazillion miles from the ocean.
Do you know where the Ohio River is formed?
I do not know where the Ohio River is formed.
The Ohio River is formed at the confluence of the Allegheny River.
Oh, is it in
and the Monongahela River, right there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And it runs to the ocean, right? It does run to the ocean.
The Ohio, I think it runs to the Mississippi.
Okay. It's still... Okay, probably a long way from the Mississippi still, where I was.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not sure where it joins. My geography's not that
The thing
up
is,
to date.
I'm from a little island. The rivers have no opportunity to get that big.
Oh, yeah, right, sure.
The longest river in England is like 100 miles. So when they hit the ocean, they're like, you know, you can jump across them.
Little tributaries.
Exactly. This thing, the Ohio River, is like, it took appreciable length of time to drive over the bridge.
Do you know, I lived in Pittsburgh until I was into my mid-20s, and I learned 2 weeks ago a fact about the Ohio River that I had never known, despite growing up in the city.
Do tell.
The river should be named the Allegheny River.
Okay.
Because... by traditional standard naming conventions of rivers, at least in the United States, I don't know about the rest of the world, but I was just getting this information from a guy who was spewing facts. When two rivers meet at a confluence, the larger river usually
gives
the name, continues on. Yes. Allegheny, who's bigger than the Monongahela, should continue the name.
I will say, I don't think I know of another example where two rivers converge to form a differently named third river. Again, I'm from England. They're all singletons, and they're all 50 miles long.
They're creeks.
But yeah, so but Dublin has a suspension bridge over the river in Dublin is called the Scioto, spelled S-C-I-O-T-O. It itself is bigger than any river in England. It has this suspension bridge, which is a footbridge, and linking the historic part to the new part. The new part has restaurants. It had a free video game arcade. You could just play video games for free.
Cool.
I knocked the rust off my Pac-Man skills while I was there.
Yeah, I bet you did.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
And several local breweries which had good beer. And I was like, I fell in love with the place. I talked to some locals and I said, this is a great town. I said, honestly, when I came to Ohio, I thought it was going to be empty because of so many Ohio people live in North Carolina. I didn't think there was going to be anyone left. But I said, your town is charming. And they said, yes, but you came in April. They said, the previous 6 months are why you moved to North Carolina.
Uh-huh. Yep, yep. Ethan could tell you about that firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a lovely travel Chamber of Commerce video for our podcast for Dublin, Ohio.
I was charmed by the place. And I had zero expected because I'd done zero homework.
Right.
I just expected boarded up town, nobody there.
Uh-huh. To see us in North Carolina.
Yeah. It had waterfalls in the town. You could walk to a waterfall. Series of waterfalls.
Sounds like an incredibly charming locale.
It truly was. And get this. Actually, this is the most amazing part of all. We popped into the library. The library was very charming. A new building, very interesting architecture. A worthy addition to the town. We went in and had a look around. First thing we saw was a book written by a person who I used to babysit.
Are you kidding?
I am not kidding. As a kid who,
wow,
who grew up here, but their parents were Scottish and they've moved back to Scotland now, and they've grown up apparently enough to the point where they can write novels, and the novel was on a display section of like librarian recommended books in Dublin, Ohio. I was like, what?
Very cool.
So, yeah.
How about that? Well, that's something. I don't know what that is, but it's something.
The book, the writer is, it's her initials, it's C.E. McGill. And the book, I think, is called Our Hideous Progeny. That's the book. So there you go.
Oh.
I haven't read it, all but right. Recommendation. I have held it mouth agog in Dublin, Ohio library, but...
I'm just impressed that you went to a library.
Carson needed the bathroom.
Oh. I just here thought you were a bibliophile. You went in to peruse the local library.
Plus the library part, yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, let's get down to business. How did we leave Jamie Lannister? So last we saw of Jamie, he was handing the family legacy Oathkeeper over to Brienne of Tarth in order to salve his oh-so-precious conscience. Since then, he helped his little brother to escape the Black Cells, but he hadn't banked on Tyrion actually murdering their father, Tywin. When Tywin's body was discovered, Jaime led the hunt to find Tyrion and Varys, since Jaime coerced the Spymaster to help get Tyrion free. Last chapter, we saw him standing shiver over his father's body in the Sept of Baelor. McKelly, why don't we give the summary of this one?
All right. Well, Jaime stands watch over his father's corpse. Every muscle aches. Only his missing hand still has any feeling. Balon Swan and Loras Tyrell try to relieve him, but he is determined to see out a full week. They leave him to his self-recrimination. He tries to blame Varys, who was only supposed to get Tyrion to a ship. Varys is as much to blame as Jaime or Tyrion. He recalls forcing Varys to help, who was curious as to why Jaime wanted to free Tyrion. Does Jaime believe his innocence? Jaime says it doesn't matter. A Lannister always pays his debts.
Jaime's last memory of Tyrion is his vicious statement about Cersei's infidelities and Tyrion's admission to killing Joffrey. But he hadn't added, "and I'm off to kill Dad." Jaime would have stopped him at that. Varys is now missing. Jaime imagines the two of them on a ship to Essos, toasting their success. Or Varys is murdered and left in the tunnels. Jaime had organised a thorough search of the dungeons, but they're far more extensive than he'd ever imagined. At a junction, they did find a mosaic of a three-headed dragon. There, Jaime heard Rhaegar's voice calling him Kingslayer.
He recalled their farewell. Jaime had begged leave to join Rhaegar at the Trident, but Rhaegar knew that Aerys wanted Jaime as hostage against Tywin's perfidy. Jaime protested, and Sir John Derry dressed him down, but Rhaegar was more conciliatory. After the battle, he'll call a council and make some changes. Changes did come, but not by Rhaegar, who died in the ensuing battle.
Thousands had filed past Tywin's body, most not unhappy. King's Landing remembered the sacking, but Pycelle was genuinely distraught. Jaime had interrogated the under-jailer, Rhaenyra Longwaters, about the missing jailer, Rugen. He'd had his position since Aerys' day, was rarely there, except when needed, which as Chief of the Black Cells was rarely. Tyrion, Pycelle, Ned Stark, and a trio that were sent to the Wall were the only recent occupants of the Black Cells.
Jaime wants to question the two turnkeys that worked the Black Cells, but they've been killed by the Kettle Blacks. Jaime is mad at Cersei, and with some amount of gall, accuses the Kettle Blacks as having been too keen to kill the turnkeys as if they had something to hide. He banishes them from his sight. The mummer's farce continued when the gold cloaks were sent to search the brothels for Tyrion. Jaime's thoughts turn to Brienne. He says a prayer to the father, but the god or the corpse? Doesn't matter. Neither listen.
At midnight, the Septons enter for their devotions. Their chants lull Jaime. He recalls his vigil before being knighted by Sir Arthur Dayne. A woman enters the Sept. The Septons have now left. Jaime's so tired he'd missed that. It turns out to be Cersei in full flirtation mode. She tells him that Kevin has refused and knows about their liaisons. The High Septon, too. She pleads with him to be Hand of the King. But he's firm. He was made for battle, not council chambers. She flies into a rage. A fool to come, a fool to ever love him. Then storms out.
At dawn, the devotions are punctuated by gagging. The smell is getting intolerable. The Tyrells arrive. Margaery places a large bouquet of roses at Tywin's feet, but wisely keeps one for her own nose. Jaime admires her smarts. Tommen could do worse. Cersei arrives and forces Tommen to pray. With a sob and a wrench, the little king makes a run for it. Jaime follows. Tommen wasn't scared, just appalled by the stench. Jaime tells him that a man can endure anything by just going away inside. Cersei arrives with a more heavy-handed approach to parenting. But Jaime intervenes. Their spiteful comments are ended by the arrival of Mace Tyrell. Jaime invites the Lord of Highgarden to sup with Cersei that evening.
She manages to bite her tongue until Tyrell leaves, but insists that she won't make him the Hand. Then send him to besiege Storm's End. But he won't leave King's Landing until Margaery marries Tommen. Then wed them. Who cares? He's too young to consummate it, and if things change by then, they can get it annulled. Cersei is impressed. Jaime almost sounds like their father.
We'll be right back.
Hello, friends. Are you ready to make some unforgettable memories? Well, if so, consider the Marriott Bonvoy program. Discover the perfect destination for your summer getaway and unlock exclusive deals on luxurious accommodations. With our affiliate partnership, you'll enjoy unbeatable savings and a seamless booking experience. Don't let summer slip away. Visit Marriott Bonvoy today and make this vacation season one for the books. Use our Ghosts of Harrenhal affiliate page to check it all out and buy Bonvoy points or give some as a gift. The link to our page is in the show notes. She gives him a lingering look, the description says. Mm-hmm. So she seems to almost be aroused by that concept.
Yeah, is... stop. Oh. This is already icky enough without you making it worse. But I have to say, the standing over your father's corpse for 7 days and seven nights without a break is, I mean, first of all, it's not humanly possible. And second of all, to volunteer to do it and to refuse any offer of any help smacks of something more than just grief, honestly. Like guilt. Right.
Yes, and we're in his head, so we know he is feeling immense guilt for his role in Tywin's death, which was inadvertent.
You know, it was.
He didn't mean it, but, you know, despite this guilt, he avoids confronting it directly when he's speaking from time to time to his father's corpse. And when he was thinking about Varys and Varys's role in the whole thing, he says to Tywin's corpse, your blood or something like that, your blood is on Varys's hands as much as in what he wants to say is mine, but he can't get the word out. So instead he says Tyrion's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like he still can't say something to his father that he wants to say, even though his father is dead.
I do think that psychologically it's not good for Jaime to do this. I mean, like, he has suffered a series of losses, if you think about it. I mean, he lost his father, he lost a son recently, he lost a hand. There are things that you can do to handle grief. I mean, like, throwing yourself into work to handle grief is not totally a bad idea necessarily. But if your work is just to stand there over the body brooding for 7 days and seven nights, I don't think many psychologists would recommend it.
Agreed. If we had Dr. Honda on again, I'd love to get Dr. Honda's opinion about Jamie and Cersei here. But the thing is later in the chapter, he thinks that he feels no real grief for the loss. There's no tears. He wonders where his tears are. I think it's more of guilt than grief.
Yeah.
Really?
I think so. Although, I mean, I think that bit you're referring to, that is more a sort of like a, not necessarily Jamie throwing shade at Tywin, but George Martin throwing shade at Tywin, that Jamie's saying, I can't emote my grief towards you because you yourself taught me not to.
Yes.
And so that I'm the man I am because of you. And so you don't get tears. It's your own fault.
Right. Yes. That good distinction you make there.
I also, on the subject of distinctions, I like the slight distinction that we get between Balon Swan and Loras Tyrell. We skipped over this a little bit in the summary, but Swan and Tyrell try to convince Jaime to stand down and let them take over.
Right.
Jaime says, no, it's my job. Go away. Balon Swan goes away and drags Loras Tyrell with him. Loras Tyrell wants to keep fighting the fight and wants to convince Jaime to be, but Balon Swan... And they're not very different in age, particularly, I think. Balon Swan's quite young as well.
He's young. He's not as young as Loras, but he is a young man.
But they're both new to the Kingsguard.
Yes. They were both appointed before, while Jaime was gone.
Right. Balon Swan just, you know, he just... I think Loras still thinks with his sword, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. He just keeps trying. He seems to want to fight the good fight. And not pick his battles.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is not the battle to pick. This is a man grieving for his father.
Yeah.
If he wants to continue to stay and, you know, stand vigil over him, let the man do what he needs to do.
One piece of information we gained from this chapter was that we've been told this several times, but I'd never quite believed it. Jaime really did coerce Varys into helping him. I just thought that Varys was standing next to Jaime going, you know, we could get him out if you want. I've got the key. We could get him out. But really, Varys was forced into this without any... no question about it.
Yes. We certainly see what Varys meant by... Your brother can be quite persuasive,
right.
Which is what he told Tyrion in the dungeons. And Jaime basically ambushed Varys in his chamber, knocked him down from behind, put a knife to his throat, and said, "You're gonna free Tyrion." And I thought, it might be a little bit odd to go straight to that rather than wait for Varys and say, hey, you're going to free Tyrion. Maybe he would have done it without all of the other, just the threat of the other things.
I think the strangest thing about that is that he's in Varys's chambers, and when Varys comes in, he says something along the lines of, fancy meeting you here. Well, it's my chambers. Of course I'm here.
It is.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I would have, the reason I always was always skeptical that he was genuinely coerced was because you wouldn't need to coerce Varys for this. If you asked Varys nicely, hey, do you want to help free Tyrion? He'd be like, sure.
Yeah, at least he would, at the very least, do it under the threat of the things that Jaime did. I don't think that Varys will say, you're not going to do that.
I mean,
oh, I will watch.
Now, Jaime says that Varys gets interested in what Jaime's saying because Jaime... He says, well, why do you want to let Tyrion go? Do you not believe in his guilt anymore? Do you think he's innocent? And Jaime says that doesn't matter. Lannisters always pay their debts. Now, I think you and I know what Jaime means by that. This is all to do with Tysha.
Yes.
Does Varys know the Tysha story?
We don't know if he knows the Tysha
story. I couldn't think of any time when Varys would have heard that. And Varys listens carefully to things people say, and I wonder if he's like, what did Jaime mean by that?
Right.
And Varys being the kind of person he is, I wonder if that will set him off down pathways looking for that information. Like, for instance, we don't know where Tyrion and Varys are now, but if they're together, I wonder if Varys is saying to Tyrion, what did your brother mean when he said...
So he said to me,
exactly,
pay his debt. What? And Tyrion was so angry when he last left Jaime, he might just tell him, you know what he did to me?
Well, that's true. That's very true.
But we also learned that Jaime truly doesn't know where Varys went. So far, we've only had Cersei's perspective in this book. So we were unsure whether Jaime actually knew where Varys was.
I suspected he didn't know, because it very much felt like this plan got out of Jaime's control quite quickly.
Yes, it did.
The whole Tywin being dead thing and all.
Yes, yes.
So Jaime thinks to himself that he would have stopped Tyrion if he'd known that he was going to kill his father. Then he would be a kinslayer. But I would question that. You wouldn't need to kill Tyrion to prevent him killing Tywin. You could have just marched him to the ship and put him on it.
Yeah, what I found noteworthy about that conversation is that Jaime would have, based on his phrasing, then I would be a kinslayer instead of him. Sounds to me like he's thinking he would kill Tyrion if it came to that.
I see what you mean. What he means is he would kill Tyrion to protect his father. He's not saying he would necessarily have had to do that, but he's willing to do it. Yeah, interesting.
And so Jaime would have chosen Tywin, despite the cruelty and monstrous nature, over Tyrion in that situation, is what it felt like to me.
Yeah, and that's. I mean, it's hard not to be Team Tyrion a little bit, but that's disappointing, you know? Because Tywin's a genuine monster. I mean, think about the fact you're unable to cry over his body here, Jaime. Whereas Tyrion is a brother who loves you very dearly and wants the best for you.
Yeah, now he was... There's two he's here. Jaime was just recently told by Tyrion that Tyrion killed Joffrey, who Tyrion knows is Jaime's son. So maybe he's feeling less guilty and sorry for Tyrion.
I still feel that, given the weight of evidence to suggest that it wasn't Tyrion that killed Joffrey, a angry confession to the crime would not convince me of his guilt.
Agreed. And I think in this line here about then Jaime would be the kinslayer, I think you could, if you dug deep enough, you could find a little nugget of that, because he says, then I'd be the kinslayer, not him. But Tyrion just told him that he killed Joffrey, which would make him a kinslayer and a kingslayer. But so the fact that he says I would be the kinslayer, not him, possibly means that he doesn't fully believe that Tyrion did it.
Agreed. Agreed. Good point.
So Simon's looking right now at a note that says Simon was right about Tyrion's message, and he has no idea what it's about.
You've got that
was
right.
Intentional.
But let's dwell. Anyway, I was right.
It's something you just never get tired of hearing, right? What I'm referring to is that last chapter, right?
Yes, Cersei was last
chapter. Yeah, I think it was last chapter. We were talking about Tyrion's assertion to Jaime that Cersei had sex with Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy. And you had said, I think the addition of Moonboy damages the legitimacy of the accusation.
Yes, I did say that.
And I think that does seem to be kind of what's going on in Jaime's head. He thinks about this a lot throughout the chapter.
Right.
Just randomly, his mind will go to that phrase. And I think the addition of Moonboy puts just enough spiteful hyperbole in it to discredit, if you're not wanting to believe it. If you're looking for reasons to discount what he's saying, then that addition of Moonboy, like, no, he was just lashing out.
Interesting. It's... Because we were talking last time about Cersei's ability to ignore evidence that didn't conform to her worldview.
Right.
And
yeah, I remember.
Jamie's kind of doing the same thing here. He's like, yes. Well, she definitely isn't sleeping with Moon Boy, so
right.
She's not so sleeping kind of with the, anyone.
Throw the whole thing out.
The day I catch her in bed with Moon Boy, then I'll know.
Then I'll believe him. And at the service at the end of the chapter, Cersei and Tommen are being escorted down the aisle to Tywin's body by Osmond Kettleblack. And while they're, you know,
oh, he pictures him naked,
down,
right?
He pictures them naked together, and yeah. It's really bothering him. So it's certainly, whether he fully believes it or not, it's taking hold in his mind. Like Tyrion in Cersei's mind is living rent-free.
Yes.
Now this line of Tyrion's is living rent-free in Jaime's head as well.
Lancel, Osmond Kettleblack, and Moonboy all lounging around naked in his...
That's a tough way to go.
I will say, I'm quite surprised that no Lord Commander of the King's Guard has ever thought to truly explore and map Maegor's tunnels. It's a serious breach of bodyguard duty to not know about these things.
Right. I hadn't thought about it till I saw it in the notes. And yes, especially considering that at least the third level and below seems to be mostly empty. You could have torches down there and strings running, you know, every which way, like ropes running everywhere to map out where things are. And
Tywin,
nothing.
Tywin cannot be the first ruler to have been murdered because of these tunnels. It must have happened in the past.
Maegor the Misunderstood was found dead on the Iron Throne.
Somebody used the tunnels against him.
Possibly. Or it was the throne itself.
So the interaction between, we get this in flashback, but between Rhaegar and Jaime is quite interesting. It sort of parallels the Jaime Loras Tyrell interaction. That Rhaegar, Jaime comes across as slightly in awe of Rhaegar. And Rhaegar comes across as quite considerate and thoughtful to the younger man, as if he's like, you know, he sees promise in him and wants the best for him.
Yeah, we don't know Rhaegar very well, so it's tough to know if he was that way with everybody. Just, you know, kind. I mean, according to Robert Baratheon, he kidnapped and raped Lyanna Stark, but, you know.
I would say that's one extreme of what we've heard of Rhaegar.
Right.
A lot of other people say nice things about him.
Yeah, Barristan Selmy.
Barristan
Selmy
is the one I was
Rhaegar's
most thinking of,
little
yes,
sister, indeed. But, mm-hmm. yeah. It was very clear that Jaime really wanted to fight by Rhaegar's side. Now, it's unclear if that was to protect Rhaegar because of how much esteem he held him in, or because he was young and hungry and wanted
to prove himself in battle.
Yeah. Now, on the other end, Rhaegar does put his hand on Jaime and explain that changes are coming, and it very much felt like a big brother, little brother type, everything's going to be okay when I get back. So there definitely felt like there was a level of care between the two.
There's a whole interesting fan fiction for Rhaegar coming back from that battle. Rhaegar defeating Robert. And so,
oh, you're saying there's an opportunity.
An opportunity for, yes. I mean, just the thought process of it. You know, would Rhaegar have done something to unseat his lunatic father and actually become the greatest king in the Seven Kingdoms history?
Yes. That would be pretty good.
It actually might be terribly dull.
Maybe. But I'm sure we could trump up some some drama. And...
Yeah. Probably. Yeah.
So the changes that Rhaegar mentions are coming, he never does get to see through because he's died. Now, we did discuss in Ned 10 about some things involving the changes that he had meant to do earlier and, you know, is going to do after this battle. But I went back and looked at what we talked about, and they were surprisingly spoilery. So I'm going to leave them out and hope that people forgot that we brought them up. I was like, did we really say these things? But that was back in Game of Thrones. We were still learning our way. But Jaime was left behind from the battle because he was being used as a shield by King Aerys against Tywin.
Yeah.
And Rhaegar tells Jaime the reason for this is because Aerys fears Tywin more than he fears Robert.
Yep.
And at that point, the Lannisters were not in open rebellion against the crown, against the Targaryens. So the silence from Casterly Rock was more unsettling than the known rebel forces that were that they were fighting. So I thought that was a noteworthy distinction there.
Well, in some ways, it maps to what we already know, of course, because Robert's Rebellion was... It was everything was on a knife edge at this point. And Tywin's decision of which side to come in on was going to be extremely significant to the outcome of the war. And yes, therefore, right. In many respects, he was the kingmaker here between Robert and... Now, as it turned out, Robert didn't really need him. Tywin didn't join in until the decision was already made. But had Tywin jumped in one direction or the other, that side would have prevailed. Almost certainly. Right. So I think we kind of knew all that, that Aerys was afraid of Tywin's defection to Robert.
When you explain it that way, that does make some sense. Yeah, I can see that now. But he does, Jaime does find it amusing that Aerys thought no harm would come to him if Jaime was near. That's a little bit ironic, sadly ironic. Yeah, but you know, for as paranoid as Aerys was, he was surprisingly trusting in Jaime and his Kingsguard. I was thinking about it with the level of paranoia that Aerys was feeling at this point. I would not have been surprised if he put Jaime in a position where if Tywin crossed him, Jaime would pay the price. Like dangle Jaime at the top of a wall or something, you know, outside the above a gate and say, but I think, I'm dropping him.
I think implicitly that's what he was doing by keeping him there. But of course, him being the only Kingsguard did sort of like shift things, because I think he was the only Kingsguard in King's Landing, right?
They were all pretty well spread out.
Right.
There were several with Lyanna and several with Rhaegar. So
right. Yeah. So it meant that Aerys's keeping him there was both the threat to Tywin, I've got your son, I could do anything, but you're absolutely right. Aerys should have thought, but hang on a second, he's bigger than me. But Aerys wasn't thinking too straight at the time, because if you think about what Aerys did then, he must have realized that, you know, it's like the question that Varys posed about, you know, who's got the strength, where does power lie?
Right. Right.
Power lay with Aerys, except he'd brought into his bosom an armed, dangerous man, who he then told to bring him his father's head, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah. Right. You'd have to be crazy. Yeah, but that's what Aerys was.
Right. And Rhaegar calls Robert Cousin Robert. And just a quick reminder, Robert's grandmother was Rhaell Targaryen, yeah, the daughter of Aegon V, who was aunt to King Aerys, Aerys II. So that's why he calls him cousin. But Jaime notices that a lot of sad faces and come and go, thousands of them. And he thinks most of them look really sad, but probably aren't all that sad because Tywin really wasn't all that well liked. He was respected, but not all that well liked, aside from Kevin. Kevin looked pretty upset from what we've seen from the Cersei chapters. But aside from his brother Kevin, poor Grand Maester Pycelle seemed to be genuinely broken up about the death of Tywin. And he refers to him as the greatest man I've ever known, which is quite a statement. And he served six kings.
Right. Yeah,
Maester Pycelle, not Tywin.
Yes. I understood who you meant, yes. Yeah, I think Pycelle genuinely respected Tywin, but also he's very worried about how he's seen by the Lannister children. Because we know what Tyrion thought of him.
Right.
We know what Cersei thinks of him. Jaime doesn't seem to be too bothered one way or the other. Jaime really does sort of like keep that kind of thing at arm's length. I mean, Cersei embodies all the sort of politicking and sort of like moving the pieces around the board, and Jaime just doesn't care about it. But
right,
they're the power that Tywin once was, and they do not have the same respect for Pycelle.
We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored by Audible. To get a free audiobook, or two if you're an Amazon Prime member, go to our exclusive URL, audibletrial.com/ghostsharrenhal. You can find the link in our show notes. That is true. Yeah, Jaime thinks after he talks with Pycelle, that one's dying as well. Cersei might have been right thinking that he was useless.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that could be also why he's distraught.
Yeah.
Now, the six kings that he served were Aegon the Fifth, Jaehaerys the Second, Aerys the Second, King Robert, Joffrey, and Tommen.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, Aegon the Fifth was thought of as a pretty good king, compassionate, loved by the small folk, but then it really tails off at the...
God. I mean, I'd like to think I'm better than most of them. The last four. I mean, Tommen, who knows? He could be great, but he's a kid, you know?
Right. So being the greatest man he's ever known, greater than any of the six kings, you got to color that a little bit, I guess. So, one thing is for sure is that Tywin was cold, calculating, and, as we mentioned, respected, not so much loved. So clearly these are things that Grand Maester Pycelle finds to be good in an effective ruler, an emotionless, no-nonsense kind of ruler.
Yeah.
Now, he did have a long history of supporting Tywin in the Lannister interest. Back in Tyrion 6 of A Clash of Kings, when Tyrion had Grand Maester Pycelle thrown in the dungeon, he told Tyrion that he's the one that convinced Aerys to open the gates for Tywin so that the sack of King's Landing happened, hoping that Tywin would take the Iron Throne and become the king that he felt Tywin was, would excel at. And he also let Jon Arryn die because he knew Jon Arryn knew about Jaime and Cersei's incest, and he thought that Cersei wanted Jon Arryn dead to prevent him from acting on that knowledge. So he's done a lot. He's very much always been in the Lannister camp.
Oh, yeah. Everything I said about Pycelle was predicated on that he's Lannister through and through now. And so he needs the Lannister, because he is a complete Lannister loyalist, he needs Lannister support, and he's worried he's lost it in now that Tywin's gone.
Yes.
Whenever we think about Pycelle, I always think there's self-interest is the biggest single motivator for that man.
Yeah.
Yep.
I can see that perspective.
We do get a little bit more info on Rugen. Rugen is the jailer who never came to work and has gone missing and was found
went missing.
Yes. Was found to have a coin that could only have come from the Reach in his chambers.
Right.
The crown pays for 20 turnkeys, but there's never been more than 12. And it pays for 6 under-jailers, but there are only 3. What do we make of this? We speculate that Rugen might be Varys. Just his pattern of behaviour is that of Varys, in that he comes and goes and he's only there when needed. He can't be a jailer. He's busy being Varys the rest of the time, you know?
Yeah, and there's a few specific instances, like when Rhaenyra Longwaters mentions that Rugen was in charge of the Black Cells, and that Ned Stark, Grand Maester Pycelle, and Tyrion were the most three recent in the Black Cells. We know that when Varys came to visit Ned, he came in a guard costume.
Ah.
Now, he could have been coming as a turnkey, a fill-in turnkey. And obviously when he met Tyrion at the end of Storm of Swords in the dungeon, when Tyrion was freed, he was also wearing a guard, a guard outfit. So,
But is there something to this understaffing? Is Varys skimming off the top? It seems a very mundane thing for Varys to be doing.
I think that Yes. So what we're talking about is a discrepancy between the funding for the jail system and the actual staffing of the jail system. And it certainly feels like some possible embezzlement going on here. And we have talked in the past about how Littlefinger might be embezzling or skimming. And a lot of these reports go to the master of coin. And I wonder if he is the one who is saying, yeah, we, you know, when he sends his, gives his reports, yes, we're paying for 20 turnkeys and 6 under jailers, but really they're only paying for less than half of that.
Oh, you think it's Peter Baelish that's skimming off the top?
Yes, he's skimming off, and that's because he has acquired a considerable amount of wealth. We've discussed this before, but his keep, we've been to his keep on the fingers.
It wasn't legacy wealth he was bringing.
No, and his role, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure he has some investments going, but he's got a lot. He seems to have a lot of money. So I wondered if this might be an example of where he could be skimming or embezzling.
Yeah. And then continuing the thought process, if Rugen is Varys, we do now have an intersection point between Jack and Hagar and Varys.
Yes,
which
we do.
Could be significant, because if Rugen, as head of the Black Cells, was involved in, and indeed I think Renifer Longwater says that he didn't agree with the idea of setting the 3 prisoners to the wall. He thought that was a bad idea.
Right. Ned Stark's idea, though, so.
Right, yes. But Rugen Varys may have intercepted with Jack and Hagar, and Jack and Hagar is up to something, perhaps.
I'm with you.
I have no idea why this would happen, but the two of them have met, I think we can safely say.
Right, and the Black Cells, as Renifer Longwaters tells us, are so rarely used. So it makes you wonder, what did these 3 do to end up in there? And as we've discussed in the past, how did Jack and Hagar, if we believe that he could be a faceless man, how did he end up in the Black Cells? Could that have been intentional? Possibly. Here's a scenario for you. What if Illyrio Mopatis had hired a faceless man to do something here in Westeros, and Varys kept him in the Black Cells as the start of whatever goal that they ultimately had?
Very interesting.
We do know that it's heavily suspected, and the Ghost of High Heart's dream suggests that a faceless man killed Balon Greyjoy, and we know that a man whose description very much matches the new description of Jack and Hagar got the key that opens every door in the Citadel in the prologue of this book. So maybe they're using him to destabilize the realm, as Varys and Illyrio had planned.
Yeah, and as Rugen, Varys could control who gets brought to the Black Cells, and once they're in the Black Cells, only he can talk to them, you know, sort of thing. So
interesting.
One thing I noticed throughout this chapter is that at various points, Jaime's having a little bit of trouble remembering what he ought to know and not know about the whole Tyrion Tywin thing. And I worry that he's going to get himself into trouble, particularly being as tired as he is, that he might say something out of turn.
Oh, yes, good point.
At one point, he wants to interview the turnkeys, and then he's mad about them getting murdered. But that's got to be good news for him. The less evidence that can be gathered, the better, because he is involved.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe he just feels bad that they got murdered for nothing. Maybe that's all.
There's some of that. He thinks to himself, I told Varys no one is to get hurt in this. I guess I should have told that to my brother and sister.
Yeah.
So there might be some of that. Overall, I think he's doing a decent job of executing an investigation into the murder and escape that he had a very big hand in. You know, he's doing all the things, like sending the gold cloaks to search the brothels and interviewing the under jailer here and standing vigil over the body.
Yeah, also investigating the tunnels is a good idea, because he must. It's a legitimate thought that once you've murdered Tywin, you might come down and murder Varys as well. To find Varys' body down there is definitely a possibility.
Yeah, so I feel like he's got his tracks fairly well covered. I think at this point, the biggest issue is guilt.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've got one that I'll bring up in pedantry. It's not serious, but it's just enough to make me go, is this guy in the right mind? Is he going to keep his... are those loose lips going to sink this ship?
All right, I look forward to it. So, speaking of the turnkeys that were killed, Cersei, when Jaime approaches the Kettle Blacks about, you know, them, he seems very shocked when he learns from Renifer Longwaters that these turnkeys were killed. And then he confronts the Kettle Blacks and he takes in the scene about their death, about you know, the scene of the turnkeys' death. And they say, hey, Cersei said she wanted them to sleep forever. So we were just doing what Cersei said. And that's when he comes up with that story. Hey, you did that a little too quickly. I might wonder whether you were involved in this somehow. Well, we were there when Cersei said this. It was in Cersei 1 in Tywin's chamber. And you know who else was there when this conversation happened? Was Jaime. So so he was in the chamber during the conversation, but now he seems entirely shocked by this fact. So clearly he wasn't paying attention when Cersei said this. So,
by the way, I don't have anything to say in pedantry now.
Oh, okay.
That is basically it. That's basically what I was going to say. Yeah. That's.
Oh, is that.
Yeah. I mean, that's pedantry, right? I mean, he knew they were going to do this, and to be surprised and maddened when they did it just seems.
Okay. I ruined your pedantry. We could take all this and play it in pedantry.
It's fine. Everything you said rings true for me. And on the subject of Cersei, she's still obsessed with who Tyrion has told and what they know. So last chapter, she kept returning to the High Septon as Tyrion's man and wondering what he knew. We hear this again via Jaime. And now she's adding Kevin to the mix as well. She's telling Jaime that Kevin knows as well. Tyrion's told everyone, you know. And
yeah,
she really wants to keep this under wraps. Jaime, of course, has taken the other tack of, let's get married.
Yeah, I'm guessing Kevin very possibly was just observant and present.
Yeah.
And noticed there's something fishy going on here.
Yeah. The way to get these two idiots to crack is to say, hey, are you two sleeping together? What? They would give themselves up in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's
right. On the subject of these two as lovers, they never seem to be on the same wavelength. Each of them seems wait for the worst possible moment to make advances to the other one.
They like to make advances over dead bodies.
And dead bodies are a big factor, yeah. As if it's not icky enough.
We see Cersei here exploiting what she knows Jaime wants. She says to him, "We will please be my Tommen's Hand of the King. We will rule as king and queen." And we know that's exactly what Jaime said to her over Joffrey's body, as, you know, we'll be king and queen, or we'll go back to Casterly Rock. Who cares about the Iron Throne? You know, and it's her trying to manipulate and giving and withholding love. You know, she says, you said you'd love me, and it's not loving to make me beg. And then, you know, I need my other half with me, in me. And then when he rejects her, she snatches that love away. And I was a fool to ever have loved you. And, yeah, you know, it's very clear what she's up to here.
Yeah. I will say that eventually she's going to stop asking him, because he's nothing if not consistent about his desire to stay as Lord Commander of the Kingsguard and to not be the Hand of the King. He could not be more emphatic.
No, he really couldn't. He really hasn't minced words here.
Yeah.
About this.
So you notice that when Jaime gives Tommen the advice to go away inside, and I'm doing air quotes for the listeners, that poor little Tommen started to say that, oh, I already know that trick because I used to do it when Joffrey... And then he doesn't finish the sentence. And I just hope that all he was going to say at the end of that sentence was, brutally tortured me physically and psychologically, because...
Yeah.
There are worse things. I mean, that's what you'd expect from Tommen, from Joffrey, just that. But it did feel like he might say something even worse, but God help us.
This family. Being Joffrey's younger brother, surely the torment that he had to endure.
I
could certainly understand him having learned to go away inside. And then his mother comes out and says, Joffrey would never have shamed me so. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
Nothing he did ever brought you more shame than this? This is the pinnacle. Nothing Joffrey has ever done has been this shameful. Are you sure about that? Shall we take a moment and think?
One area where Cersei seems to fall down for me, compared to Jaime, is the sort of outside-the-box thinking. She's constantly maneuvering, I've said this before, to sort of surround herself with the people that she wants. But she doesn't seem to have any ideas for what she'll do with this dream team once it's assembled.
Yes,
Jaime's the one who comes up right at the end of this chapter with this solid plan to move their interests forward and to rid themselves of Mace Tyrell's annoying presence. Give him something to do outside King's Landing. Go besiege Storm's End. That is A, extremely difficult, and B, might get him killed.
Right.
And
and
they can then move on with their lives without him there, and it would make her much happier for this to happen.
Yeah, and Jaime's the one that arranges the dinner for Cersei and Mace to kick this whole thing off. Seemingly something that Cersei hadn't bothered to think of as very prudent. And Jaime adds, yes, there's much and more that you can do for little Tommen. So, you know, he's giving Mace something to do, making him feel important, a bit of flattery.
Yeah.
You would think Cersei would be pretty good at that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But maybe she's trying so hard to rule like what she thinks or how she thinks a man would rule that she's forgetting about using subtle things like flattery and giving out tasks to make people feel important, because she can't be this bad at manipulating.
The problem is that she wants to achieve her own ends, which is to have not someone who isn't a Tyrell as Hand of the King. That's all she wants, and she's so fixated on it, she can't think of the alternative routes to this, such as redirecting the Tyrells somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. And you know what's ironic is that multiple times in the two Cersei chapters so far in this book, she has thought of Jaime as a fool who never thinks before he acts.
Yeah.
And here Jaime is like, no, this is the, I've set you down the path. Now just follow it to success.
And so their hope is that Mace's patience runs out this time and he elects to storm the gates of Storm's End and therefore get himself killed. And that's a reference to the fact that he besieged Storm's End in Robert's Rebellion, right?
Yes, when Stannis and Renly were stuck in there.
And his patience never ran out. He just sat there, eating in front of them while they boiled their shoes.
And until Davos came with his onions.
Yeah. All right, just a little bit of a spoiler section for our top Buy Me a Coffee sustainers. Join one of the higher tiers and you'll get access to this. Well, thank you for the spoilers. That's excellent. Can do you have some background for us? Maybe background that isn't spoiler this time.
well, we're going to talk about the chief under jailer Renner for Longwaters, who is very proud of his surname, claiming that he descends from a princess who was, in his words, the fairest treasure of the Maiden Vault. Now, we know from a previous background that the Maiden Vault is the name for King Baelor confining his sisters within the Red Keep to prevent them from tempting him with impure thoughts. Now, the Targaryen princess Renifer speaks of is Elaena Targaryen, and if she sounds familiar, it's because in a Storm of Swords chapter, we talked about Brown Ben Plum's Targaryen heritage and that he also descended from Elaena, or so he believes anyway. Well, I should say. Or so it's believed anyway. But the great knight that Renifer claims as an ancestor was Elaena's firstborn son, John Waters. The great Admiral Lord Oakenfist, who fathered the bastard boy, was Alyn Valerian. Renifer mentions that Alyn was married to another. That would be Baela Targaryen. And if you watch House of the Dragon, she's the oldest daughter of Prince Daemon and his second wife, Lyanna Valyrian.
Okay.
Anyway, John Waters and his twin sister, Jane Waters, were Elaena's first children. She had actually hoped to marry Alyn Valyrian, but unfortunately, he was lost at sea. And as Renifer tells us, John's son changed his name to Longwaters so as to show that he's descended from an anointed knight rather than carrying around the bastard name of Waters.
Interesting. Very good. All right, so comparison with the television show, I just have an apology here, really, which is I missed something from last week. But since these two chapters are basically on each other's toes, I don't feel too bad about it. Cersei and Kevin did have a contretemps, which is basically caused by, at a small council meeting, she offers Kevin the now made-up title of Master of War. And he refuses, calling Cersei the Queen Mother, and saying he'll be waiting for King Tommen in Casterly Rock, and he departs. This was done at a small council meeting, at which Cersei, showing a little deafness, gave Mace Tyrell extra responsibilities, adding Master of Coin to his already being Master of Ship. He was appeased and all very happy about this. So there you are, you see, right. A little bit of thought, you can get this done. She at the same meeting, she said she was going to keep the Hand of the King open until Tommen was ready to appoint his own hand.
Okay.
But
good stuff.
Really, this chapter was entirely dropped. There's no real investigation into the Tyrion thing.
All right.
Pedantry, we kind of covered it, which is basically Jaime seems a little bit confused about what he does and doesn't know. He, as you said, he heard Cersei give the order to, in all but name, kill the turnkeys. And then got mad at the Kettle Blacks for killing them. So,
and seemed to have forgotten.
Yeah.
Because he said, I want to speak to the turnkeys. And the underjailer said, oh, they're dead.
Right. The other thing is,
surprised and shocked.
Because this whole chapter is told in sort of flashback from Jaime's perspective as he stands over Tywin's, it was quite confusing what the heck was going on. Because Renifer Longwaters reminds him of the thing he should have already known, which is the turnkeys were dead. And then the next scene, he's standing in the room with the dead bodies and the Kettle Blacks as if he's just stumbled across it. It's like, Renifer, did you not think to clean this up? I mean...
Yeah. Well, that's what Jaime tasked the Kettle Blacks with doing, I think.
Right, yeah. All right. News and notes. What do you got for us?
Well, if you just can't wait for House of the Dragon Season 2 to premiere on June 16th, you're in luck. A House of the Dragon coloring book will debut on May 7th. And if you're too impatient to wait for that, well, George Martin has provided 2 pages for free on his blog, which is georgemartin.com/notablog. The coloring book will include more than 75 illustrations and cost around $19. And you can pre-order now at most of the places that you buy books. So get your colored pencils out.
All right.
Get coloring.
Sounds like fun. Casting has been finalized for the Duncan Egg characters in HBO's upcoming A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms live-action show. Peter Claffey has been hired to play the lovable Lunk Dunk the Tall. Claffey is a rugby player turned actor. And yeah, he is pretty tall. He's 6'4", or about 1.96 meters. As for Egg, he'll be played by 9-year-old Dexter Sol Ansel, who might be the cutest child I've ever laid eyes on. he might be young, but he's been around the acting game for a while, most recently in the Hunger Games prequel, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
Can't wait. Very exciting. Mm-hmm. I hope they start filming soon.
Yeah.
And we've got a treat for you all next week. Our dear friend Jenny of Oldstones has agreed to fire up her microphone and fill in for me as Simon's co-host next week. I just want to thank her because it's really going to help me out. I've got family coming in and my sister's flying all the way in from L.A. Molly's musical is next week. She's playing Regina George in Mean Girls. I sent you a clip, by the way. I don't know if
I saw that you sent me a clip, but I haven't seen it yet. But I'm looking forward to watching the clip.
It's just from a rehearsal.
I don't think I'm going to be able to get to the play.
That's understandable, yes.
I want to. I knew it sounds really good. Tough. I mean, your daughter is a mean girl. That's not typecasting at all.
I know, right? There was a an article about her in the student newspaper this past week and referred to her as the nicest mean girl.
Oh, so. That's nice.
So anyway, thank you, Jenny.
Yes, thank you, Jenny.
Allowing me to focus.
I'm really looking forward to it because it's fun to do this with Jenny instead of you. I mean,
I'm sure. Yeah. Yes, I can understand.
Yeah. All right, and we got a review from Alva Celias on Apple Podcasts in Brazil. Hey, it's entitled "The Goat," which I assume is a good thing.
The Black Goat of Cohor.
Possibly. This is one of the best podcasts I've ever heard. It's so much fun to spend time hearing you guys talk about one of my favorite things in the world. May the old gods bless you and Relor light your way. I'm hearing from Brazil, by the way. Thank you. Vala Morgulis. Well, Vala do Harris, Alves Elias. Thank you very much for that. We really appreciate it. When the roadshow comes to Brazil, we'll let you know.
Yes, right. Thank you so much. Great review. We greatly appreciate it. Please keep up reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, everyone. It's really helpful for us.
Yeah, it's making a difference. All right, let's conclude this one. So, Jamie is not going to be Hand of the King. I think that's a safe assumption at this point.
You think? One more time. Yeah. Maybe she could just ask him just once more.
This book has so few chapters, and so many of them have been dedicated to her asking him that question over and over again.
The 10th time will be the charm. Yeah. I can feel it.
And he definitely regrets freeing Tyrion, not necessarily because Tyrion is free, but because he really did not intend for Tywin to die, and he has significant guilt over his part in this.
Yeah, and he's been unable to grieve for the man that taught him that feelings were a weakness.
Well, you reap what you sow, Tywin.
Yes, you do.
And
yes,
he sure do. Has a plan for getting rid of Mace Tyrell, which is a solid plan, I think.
Yeah. As long as Cersei executes it.
Right. If she can just stay nice for one supper.
Yes, it's all laid out for her. Just execute the plan, please.
And next week we have Brienne. So no doubt closing in on her quarry. And
yes. She's certainly on her way up the Way Castles to the Eyrie right now.
And Jenny and I will have a lot of laughs and fun discussing that. Anyway. So there's four ways that you can help us. You could leave us a positive review like Alva Celias did. And there's no better way to spread the word, so please do that. You can buy merchandise at ghostsofharrenhal.threadless.com. You could buy us a cup of Arbor Gold at buymeacoffee.com/ghostharrenhal. If you join us at any of the various sustained levels, there's a tier to match your budget and interest. And if you've got the money, you can get into that spoiler tier and listen to all the things that you're not hearing. You could just make a donation directly to our cause at our website, ghostsofharrenhal.buzzsprout.com.
And if you're looking for more ways to interact with us, keeping up on the latest Ghost of Harrenhal news and developments, check us out on our social medias. You can follow us on Twitter, at Ghost Harrenhal. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Discord, and YouTube.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.